Hi, this is E.E. Knight, author of the Vampire Earth series, and you're listening to the SF Signal podcast.
The SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this is episode number 42, an interview episode. And I had the opportunity to chat with author E.E. Knight, who is the author of a couple of different series that are available from Rock, the Vampire Earth series, which starts with Way of the Wolf, I believe, and the Age of Dragons series. And as I said, both are available from Rock. And he and I sat down to talk a little bit about those books and some other stuff like deep dish pizza. So let's jump right in. Here's the interview with E.E. Knight. And tonight, I have the opportunity to sit down with award-winning author E.E. Knight, who is a novelist and the author of a couple of pretty long-running series now, Vampire Earth and Age of Dragons. I think Vampire Earth has 9 titles. Age of Dragons has 6, and they're both published by Rock. Hi.
Hi. Great to be here with you, Patrick.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. I said just a couple of minutes ago before we started, I try to keep this a little bit loose. Why don't you tell our listeners, who is E.E. Knight?
Okay. E.E. Knight is a mid to late middle-aged science fiction fantasy author. Been in the genre since I started reading adult books, more or less. Some of the first adult books I was ever given, were from my father's science fiction collection. He gave me E.E. Doc Smith's Lensman and Skylark series, and that's what kicked it off for me.
Very cool.
And I've been reading science fiction and fantasy ever since.
And how did you get started writing science fiction and fantasy? What was the genesis there? I mean, what kind of tipped you over and said, "Hey, I think I can do this."
I think I always liked writing stories. One of the first things I ever did was a piece of fanfic based on The Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think I wrote it when I was 9 or 10 on a manual typewriter that my mom had in college, and I think she's still got the story stuck in a drawer somewhere. It's
aren't moms
I've
great?
Always been, yeah. Monster movies, monsters. Writing has always been a part of my life. I can't think of a time when I wasn't doing it. I'm just getting paid for it now. It's one of those situations where my hobby has gradually evolved into my source of income.
I'm looking at your Wikipedia page here just for some inspiration. I see that you were born in Wisconsin, but you're living in Illinois now.
I actually grew up in Minnesota, so I consider myself a little bit more of a Minnesotan than a Wisconsinite or an Illinoisan, I guess.
And I hear that in your voice now when you said Minnesota.
Yeah, it's funny. When I get talking to my parents, they're retired in Sarasota now, but we both revert to the, "Oh yeah, well, you know, we went out to dinner the other night, you know, and it was pretty good, you know, not too bad a deal." So yeah, I can fall back into it with a fellow traveler from the upper Midwest pretty easily.
My first experience with Minnesota was, number one, it was really, really cold. Number two, that was the first time I'd ever had a baked sweet potato with cinnamon butter. Oh, it was so good. But now you're in Chicago, home of the pizza, which...
Yeah. Lumalnati's, in my opinion, is the best pizza in Chicago. Everybody's got their own opinion about it.
Are you deep dish or the thin crust?
I am a deep dish guy.
Oh, I love deep dish. Oh.
Although I'm in a mixed marriage. My wife is a thin crust. She likes the classic... Neapolitan style Italian pizzas with the super thin crust and a lot of herbs on it, which I'm perfectly happy with too. But yeah, I'm a deep dish guy.
What a lot of people don't understand is when they think of Chicago style pizza, they think deep dish, but there's really two Chicago styles. There is a deep dish, but there's also that thin crust with the cheese on top. I love that one. That's the one that we used to make. My dad had a restaurant there, and that's what we used to make.
Oh, yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, Lumalnati's, my dad calls it upside-down pizza because they put the sauce on the top, and then there's the cheese and sausage and all that stuff, and then you've got the delicious butter crust. I think they've got an online website. You can get it anywhere in the country nowadays because once people get into Lumalnati's, it stays with them. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you can have arguments about food in Chicago. If you want to really get the hairy eyeball, go to a good Chicago hot dog place and ask for ketchup.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And they'll just no soup for you. You know,
I had someone at a barbecue ask me for ketchup and I said, get out of my house.
Yeah. Everything else on it under the sun, but no ketchup.
No ketchup. Nope. If you're a little kid, you can have ketchup on your hot dog. But once you get to a certain age, you have to put mustard on there.
And people are pretty passionate about their Italian beef around here.
Yes.
Artisans of the different places. My personal favorite is Johnny's up on North Avenue in Elmwood Park. If you ever happen to be in Chicago, it's not too far from O'Hare. You could actually hop in a cab. It's just a little roadside stand. It's fries cooked in beef tallow, you know, the way God did.
Yep.
Really good stuff.
I grew up in the Berwyn Cicero area. I was there until I was about 10. And I know exactly what you're talking about. That stuff is great. Ugh. But you know what? I digress. I could talk about food forever. but what I really want to talk about is Valentine. What are you doing to this poor guy?
He's, you know, it's a long-running science fiction series, and I guess most people follow the Horatio Hornblower model, where, you know, through a series of successes, the guy rises through the ranks and eventually reaches the peak of his profession. You know, Hornblower started out as a rat-eating midshipman and retired, you know, on full pay as Grand Admiral of the Fleet in C.S. Forrester's series. Again, honor Harrington, there's a lot of people who are doing that sort of thing in military SF and fantasy. And I just decided to break the mold a little bit. And about midpoint in his career, things went south on him. And he got court-martialed and bounced out of it and kind of went into a deep funk and left the fight against the vampires in the Vampire series and reluctantly rejoined it. And he's kind of on the fringes of things now, but still playing an important role.
So for the benefit of our listeners, why don't we explain a little bit about Vampire Earth, the series, and then you can talk a little bit more about the main character, David Valentine.
Okay. Well, the best way to describe Vampire Earth, my short speech on it, is just imagine occupied Europe circa 1943, you know, swap out the Nazis for these rather Lovecraftian vampires, and you pretty much have it. They're not Bela Lugosi-style vampires or Twilight series vampires where they're good-looking or anything like that. They're not
shiny.
Lovecraftian extraterrestrials, and they don't try and be charming. They just are farming or ranching us as livestock, and there's a human resistance. And the main character, David, is a fighter in that resistance.
And he has been fighting for 9 books now.
Yeah. Off and on, yes.
And he's gone through hell.
It's not been a pleasant journey, and there have been a few volumes that have ended on a downbeat. So, you know, the race is not going to go to the swiftest. It's going to go to, you know, the guy who just refuses to give up, and that's David in a nutshell. He just doesn't give up.
Well, you get huge points for having non-shiny, non-sparkly vampires.
Yeah, I'm definitely not in the non-shiny, non-sparkly vampires. Although my wife very, very much likes the Native American hot werewolves in the Twilight series. So
I can understand.
Riff tracks so that I can take it. You know, you got to have Mike Nelson doing a commentary, otherwise.
Well, it's got to be rough in your house. I mean, first the pizza thing, now the werewolf thing.
Yeah, and she likes Joel better, and I like Mike Nelson on Mystery Science Theater. So we truly have a mixed marriage.
Wow, yeah. that's got to be fun. you know, I can see that just causing all kinds of problems. So you've got the Vampire Earth. You've run that through. You're in Marchin Country, correct? That's the latest book.
Yeah, that's the ninth volume, which is going to wrap up the story of the founding of this new freehold in the Kentucky area, the Appalachian foothills. A military operation where several different freeholds, who are these geographical areas that are fighting the vampires, tried to team up and start a new one, and it was a bit of a disaster, but David raked together some good things out of the rubble of the disaster, and there is a small but thriving freehold going in Kentucky, and that's what the last three books have been about. That's I kind of work in three book arcs. Like the first three books are really about David's biography, who he is, where he came from, and the second three books are about, you know, his rise and how he came to fame, and then how he fell out of favor with his freehold, and then we got into this this Kentucky operation.
Now, people need to understand that this is not an alternate history series. This is a near future alternate history.
Yeah, it's a post-apocalyptic, I guess I'd call it, but it's set a couple of generations into the apocalypse. Again, I wanted to do something a little different. There's a whole lot of post-apocalyptic fiction where you've got people who, you know, it's in the first few years of chaos after everything went south. I wanted to do something a little more like Orwell did in 1984, where all the huge change to society happened a couple of generations ago. So memories of what things were like before the vampires came are it's almost out of living memory now, and you don't have much to go on because there's so much propaganda being put out by the vampires, the Kurians I call them, about how they came and rescued humanity from its own folly.
But really, they kind of started it all.
I've never absolutely said whether or not they started it all, or they were just opportunists and they waited until weed screwed up badly enough to where they could come in and kind of pick up the shattered pieces, so to speak.
Gotcha. Well, I won't put you on the spot here and make you give us an exclusive and tell us the truth.
Well, I like hearing opinions from readers. That's one of the best parts of being a writer, is this sort of mind meld you get with each individual reader.
Sure.
Like David and Anka and Duvalier are all a little bit different in each person's mind, and the ideas and so on that people come up with and write to me about. It's really fascinating. Every now and then I get an email where I'm just blown away. I think, wow, I never really considered that. That's pretty perceptive. And here this poor person is thinking, my God, Knight's a genius. He's got all this ninth level stuff going on. And nope, not at all.
do you have a lot of interaction with your readers and fans? I mean, do you go to conventions, interact with them? Do you have like a forum?
I've cut back on my conventioneering since we've got a toddler now, somewhat, but I still try and make a few cons every year. And of course there's, you know, EE Knight's got a thriving Facebook site, and I've got the Twitter, and I've got EEKnight.com, and, you know, it's very easy for people to email me. And then I do, you know, local appearances at libraries and things like that, and the occasional signing. So yeah, I'm always eager to talk with readers about my books.
Well, I the only reason I ask is because I'm thinking of, you know, when authors have these longer running series, and there's lots of intricate, you know, plot threads kind of running through there. You tend to get a lot of theories and guesswork. And, you know, Robert Jordan is a good example. You know, when he would go to cons, people would come up to him and say, you know, I think that such and such killed Asmodean. And he'd be like, you know, kind of nodding his head. Nope, you're absolutely wrong. You know, and stuff like that. And they even have the wiki for it now, where, you know, all these theories and different things on there. And he would say stuff like, well, you know, they've got it, you know, 60-40 right now, 60% yes, 40% no. And I was just curious if you have that kind of interaction with people, you know, trying to guess, you know, who started this or how did this go on, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, there's a few different things that people are very intrigued about. One is Valentine's been enhanced by these aliens who are cousins to the vampires. It's kind of like a good bad dichotomy that they're here helping humanity in their war against the Kurians, and they physically altered him. He went through these different stages. The shorthand for them is wolf and cat and bear and so on. I've hinted pretty clearly that there is a fourth stage beyond that. There was a lot of speculation about it. I've started to explain it now. And you learn more about it in this ninth book. But again, I try and do something a little bit different. So, sure. So as readers, the ninth book will find out. I don't go down the same path that I did for the others.
Now, I just want to switch gears for just a second and ask you a little bit about the Age of Fire.
Yeah, well, that I love anthropomorphic animal adventure type stories. Probably my favorite novel ever written is Watership Down by Richard Adams about the rabbits. Had a huge effect on me, and I've always liked dragons too. Ever since reading The Hobbit as a youngster, and good old Smaug, and I like Anne McCaffrey's dragons, and there have been a lot of great takes on dragons over the years, but I wanted to just have them be another race trying to survive in the world. So I wrote a family history about a group of dragon hatchlings. They're all hatched at the same time, and each takes a very different path in what happens with their life. They're more high fantasy than the Vampire series, which is very dark and so on. These are a little bit more bright and sparkly and fun. But there's still some dark stuff happens to the family to break it apart. I think I started the Age of Fire series after about the third book in the Vampire Earth series, because I was getting all these emails from really young kids, and you know, like these 9 and 10 and 11, you know, tweens were reading my books and writing me about it, saying you know, stuff they liked. And there's some pretty harsh stuff in the Vampire series, you know, between the language and the violence and the sex, and, you know, it's about soldiers. So I decided to do something a little more, you know, Kipling Jungle Bookish for all ages.
Sure.
And I settled on dragons. You know, I wanted to tell an animal point of view story. So these dragons, you know, the usual dragon that appears in a fantasy novel is there to help out the hero or be an enemy to the hero. These dragons are more neutral. They're just trying to survive in the world. They've got, you know, requirements for food, and they eat precious metals to keep their scale healthy. And so they've been hunted to very near extinction. And it's about the last few surviving dragons and how they're trying to continue on with their species.
You've got 9 books in Vampire Earth.
Yeah, and 5 in the Age of Fire series about the dragons.
And so, I mean, what's your plan here? Are you planning on having X amount for each series?
Or? Well, the Age of Fire series is going to wrap itself up, I think, with the 6th volume, which is Dragon Fate, and that will be out in December of this year, December 2011. So that series will be put to bed. Vampire Earth still has a ways to go. Originally, when I plotted the whole thing out, there were a dozen books, but a couple of them got so long that I had to break them into 2 or even 3 volumes. So I think we're up to like 15 now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Finish up Vampire Earth. So I still have 6 more books to do in Vampire Earth.
But you're looking forward to it.
Yeah. And provided, you know, they don't get you know, a story doesn't get real long again where I have to break it up again. yeah, I think the next one, which is as yet untitled, I'm working on it now, is going to really be of interest to the long-term readers. It's going to feature a fan favorite character, the number one fan favorite character. So I'm looking forward to that.
Very cool. You know, when you finish Age of Dragons, are you just going to concentrate on Vampire Earth or Age of Fire? I'm sorry. Are you just going to concentrate on Vampire Earth, or you think you're going to launch something else just to kind of be able to bounce back and forth?
Yeah, I like to be able to bounce back and forth. I think it keeps me fresh. Sure. I don't want to talk too much about it because it's not sold yet. But yeah, I have another project that I'm hoping to get off the ground. I want to get Age of Fire, you know, put to bed, and this next three book series in Vampire Earth up and running. But I'm hopeful that that I will have a deal shortly for my next project.
Very cool. So everything right now is available from Rock.
Yeah, Penguin's Rock imprint. Yeah, it's in bookstores, or what's left of them anyway. And, you know, Kindle and Nook and things like that.
That was going to be my next question. Are you doing ebooks?
Well, it's not so much me. It's, you know, the publisher. I think the very first Dragon book, the Dragon Champion, is still there. For some reason, it hasn't appeared on Kindle yet. It's out in Nook. But everything else is in both Nook and Kindle, except for my media fiction. I wrote a Laura Croft book, and I don't know if that's in both formats yet.
And they're actually planning on, I think, rebooting that movie franchise.
Well, that would be cool, because I don't think they ever got her quite right in the movie, as much as I thought Angelina Jolie was an impressive physical specimen and perfect. Perfect for it. I think the writing could have been a little bit better.
I would agree. Yes. It you know, they it's always difficult, you know, trying to translate video games into movies.
Well, yeah, and everybody has this attitude that it's, you know, it's just a video game, you know. You could say it's just a play, you know, it's just War of the Worlds on Mercury Theater, you know. It's as good as you decide to make it.
You know who I think did the best job was the folks who made the Final Fantasy movie. And the reason being, I am horribly, horribly confused by the Final Fantasy video game storylines as it is. And so then to watch that movie, I was horribly confused. So I think they really captured the essence of it.
Yeah, I think when you're adapting something, you have to get somebody who absolutely loves the material, like Peter Jackson with Lord of the Rings or Frank Darabont with Stephen King's stuff. You've got to get someone who really loves it. I was watching this commentary from the guy who wrote the Flash Gordon that appeared in, what, the late 70s or early 80s.
Yes, you're talking about Dino De Laurentiis, yeah. De Laurentiis doing Sam Jones as Flash.
Yeah, Gordon. Yeah, Sam Jones and that, you know, the movie has its moments. I like Flash Gordon, and I saw this interview with the writer, and he was just dissing the source material and talking about how ridiculous it was and childish and yada yada yada. And that to me is why that movie is so odd, is that they didn't get someone who really and truly loved the story. I'd like to see someone who really and truly loves Dune get their hands on it.
Yeah, I can't see that happening. But you know what? You and I could spend a whole another half an hour talking about Flash Gordon sometime. I loved the DC reboot in the 90s. Mm. I thought that was one of the better treatments that Flash has gotten in a long time. Where he was the basketball player, it was like a 9-issue miniseries.
Yeah, my I really liked that cartoon they did. They did a movie version of it that's really impressive, but it's practically impossible to find. You have to kind of watch a crappy YouTube of somebody's videotape of it. It's called Flash Gordon: The Greatest Adventure of All. Mm. That's a really nice version, very, very close to the original comic books. You know, they put in a lot of the old Raymond elements.
The channel formerly known as Sci-Fi's reboot was not so good.
Yeah, yeah. I only caught a couple of episodes of that, and
it was painful. Very, very painful. So let's throw out some websites for our listeners. Where can they find you online?
Oh, sure. EEKnight.com, just, you know, one word, is kind of the main area. And from there, you can find, you know, the Facebook and the Twitter and the Live Journal and so on, and my email address. Or, you know, just do a Google search for Vampire Earth or Age of Fire, and you'll get your way to me one way or another.
And then you said you kind of have limited your conventions. Do you have any plans for conventions this year?
Yeah, I'm guest of honor out at Oricon this fall in Portland, which will be fun because I've got family up in the Seattle area. That's so cool. So that I'm really looking forward to that. I'm probably going to either do World Fantasy or World Science Fiction. I just haven't made up my mind yet. I'm leaning towards Reno, just because I'm a big fan of Reno 911, and I want to go eat at tacos.
Well, World Fantasy sold out.
It is? It's sold out already? Okay. Yes. I've got a toddler, so I'm completely cut off from the world. So
I saw the tweet about 2 or 3 weeks ago saying that it had sold out.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess WorldCon it is then.
So yeah, Reno. Reno, baby. Well, anything else you wanna tell our listeners about before I let you go?
Well, I just wanna thank any of my readers who I'm sure I'll be linking to this podcast, who decided to sit down and join us, so to speak, on the podcast. And I'll keep writing them if you keep reading them, and please support your local bookstores and independent sellers.
Absolutely. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick.
And thanks again to E.E. Knight for coming on the show. We do appreciate it. That was an awesome chat. If you are interested in the works of E.E. Knight, please visit eeknight.com. That's K-N-I-G-H-T. And he has stuff about himself, stuff about the books, news. He's got a little blog there. He's got links to all his Twitter, Facebook, so on and so forth. So do check that out. If you, the listener, would like to be a part of this podcast, now is your chance. You can give us a call on the voicemail line. Tell us what you think. 720-277-9082. If that is a long-distance call for you and you don't want to make a long-distance call, just go to sfsignal.com and click on a podcast post. There's a flash widget there, courtesy of Google. And if you plug in your number, Google will call you, saving you that dime, even though I know it costs more than a dime these days. If you enjoy this podcast, there's a couple other things you can do for us. Number one, you can tell a friend or two. You can go on iTunes, give us a couple stars, maybe write us a review. All these things help to boost our signal and our exposure on iTunes and get more listeners. Next week, we'll have another great topic and another great interview. Between then and now, feel free to visit sfsignal.com for tidbits and mind melds and all kinds of other cool stuff. You can follow John D. at twitter.com/sfsignal. That is the main feed on Twitter for sfsignal.com, and he links to all kinds of cool stuff all through the week. If you're looking for me, well, I'm on Twitter too. twitter.com/atfmb. That's all things from my brain. That's it for me, folks. I'm out of here. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.